You're listening to The Takeaway Podcast. Find out where The Takeaway is playing in your area by going to thetakeaway.org/stations.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And we begin this hour with an issue and a debate that may have the power to move an important constituency in the state of Texas. The solidly red state of Texas has a huge Latino population. And there were hints in the 2012 election that Latino voters in Texas, frustrated over gridlock in Washington, the economic setbacks for the middle class, and the absence of a national policy on immigration, may be evolving into a reliable constituency for the Democratic Party. Then last month, the majority Republican Texas legislature signaled that it was not about to shed its conservative credentials at all. Governor Rick Perry signed into law a ban on abortions after 20 weeks of pregnancy.
It is our responsibility and duty to give voice to the unborn, the individuals whose survival is at stake. This bill lives up to that responsibility. It also is our responsibility to improve the quality of care for women in this state, ensuring that any procedure they undergo is performed in clean, sanitary, and safe conditions by capable personnel.
That Republican victory followed a narrow defeat for the exact same bill a few weeks earlier when pro-choice Texas women mobilized and with some savvy procedural moves, including a filibuster, won the day.
Senate Bill 5 would prohibit an abortion past 20 weeks of gestation, and that gestational age itself, there's some argument about the way it's defined in the bill.
That filibuster, very long filibuster, by state Democratic Senator Wendy Davis made her an instant national political figure and framed the national debate on abortion once again as a divide between men and women, a gender gap that puts women solidly in the Democratic Party camp nationally. That's the theory anyway. But what of Texas? The abortion law has started a potentially crucial debate among Latino politicians that could have implications for how the state votes in national elections and what its congressional delegation will look like after next year's elections. Lillian Ortiz joins us. She's a board member of the National Abortion Rights Action League, or NARAL, pro-choice Texas. Lillian, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John.
My question to you is, why do you think the Republicans in Texas are doing this now, and what are the repercussions within the Latino community?
You know, John, I think that they're really just catering to a certain group within the Republican Party, an extreme part of the party. And I have to say that we've had plenty of Republican men and women who've talked to us and said, we're not very happy about this, but this is what some of our politicians are doing, again, because they're catering to primary voters here in Texas. And I think that what's happening is, without them realizing, they've kind of awoken a beast. There are a lot of people who are getting involved in not only this issue, but in politics in general at this point, who maybe weren't involved before, but feel like this was such an overreach that they really want to get involved in these issues and the movement and really want to hold elected officials accountable for what they do.
What are the specific health consequences, reproductive rights consequences, as you see them for Latina women?
Well, in Texas, Latina women have, for instance, the highest rate of cervical cancer amongst all racial and ethnic groups. And this is something that is easily diagnosed and it can be treated if caught early. But in Texas, you know, we don't have access to the preventive care services that you would expect people to have. So along the Rio Grande Valley area, where it's a predominantly Hispanic population, you see really high numbers. 39% of women don't get prenatal care when they're pregnant in Texas. So I think what you see is sort of the systemic chipping away at access to basic preventive services. And then now with the bill that just passed, you also see chipping away at access to abortion care services. So across the board, you really have a situation where Texas women don't have, especially Texas women who are poor, low income, women of color, don't have access to reproductive care services. So that just tells you a lot about where women are on the priority list for the Republican Party in the state.
Although Governor Perry explicitly said that this bill and the writers of this bill take pains to point out that it actually attempts to increase access to prenatal care and women's health care precisely in that area, that the number of clinics will go up. You don't buy it?
I don't know where they're getting that from. I think the comments that you just played from Rick Perry say a lot. You know, this bill that just passed does nothing to improve women's health care. They had every opportunity during the process to include amendments that would have done that. And at every point, they shot it down and basically said, we're not interested in that. We want the bill as is. His comments also about, you know, caring for children are, I think, very hypocritical because in Texas, one in four kids lives in poverty. The majority of those are Latinos. And we have about 30,000 kids in foster care. 40% are Latinos. And yet these same people don't do anything to help the kids who are here. They don't do anything to help the women who are trying to raise these kids. So, you know, these comments that are being made about how this improves women's health care, how this is going to be a positive, you know, that's reaching at best.
Through the filter of this abortion choice debate, do you think this issue is driving Latino voters into the Democratic camp, changing the sort of political outlook of the entire state of Texas as we get into the 2014 and 2016 election season?
I think it's definitely contributing. I think with Latinos, there's this sort of myth that we are always anti-choice or we, you know, are very conservative in our values in certain ways. And I think that we are a community that values family values. But I think that the family values that we value are a little bit different than what the Republican Party seems to think that we value.
Lillian Ortiz, NARAL Pro-Choice Texas board member, speaking to us from Houston. Lillian, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And now the Republican view within the Latino community of a state abortion law that the GOP says is pro-women's health and more about principle than politics. Texas State Representative Jason Villalba is a Republican from Dallas. He supported the anti-abortion measure and voted in favor of the bill last month when it was debated in the Texas legislature. He says this law is about protecting women of color in the state, not targeting them in some way.
A Republican takes the perspective not that we're taking away rights from our female citizens, but that we're granting rights to our most vulnerable Texans, the youngest, the smallest, the unborn. I'm now my wonderful, beautiful wife is 5 months pregnant. But when we went to the doctor to look at the sonogram and we saw the sonogram at 13 weeks and 14 weeks, I'm seeing fingers and toes and movement and you know, if you tap on my wife's belly, she would the baby would look at us. And I said to myself, this is a child. Now, I know that's the argument that we have, but I felt as a policymaker, I have a duty to protect that entity just as I would have a duty to protect a five-week-old born baby.
A couple of tough questions here. I'm a father of five, and I've seen a lot of sonograms in my day. Do you think the fact that you and your wife are involved in this wonderful story right now emotionally distorts you in terms of the public health issues of the vulnerability of the unborn versus the vulnerability of women in poverty or women who are facing unwanted pregnancies for one reason or another?
No, I don't. I mean, look, I know that I am emotionally charged by this issue because of my recent experiences having seen the sonograms. But this is my third child. So like you, I've seen a number of sonograms. What this comes down to is understanding that I feel as a policymaker that I have a duty to protect Texas citizens. And so I weigh that versus the concerns that people have expressed on the other side about taking away women's rights and rights to reproductive health and, more importantly, rights to this procedure. But remember, we're not prohibiting abortion in the state of Texas. We're just saying that currently, under current law, after 24 weeks, you cannot have an abortion except in the case of severe fetal abnormality or health to the mother. And we're moving that period back to 20 weeks because it's become clear from the scientific perspective that, you know, at 20 weeks, we're nearly viable. I mean, I think the statistics show that even at 21 weeks, babies can be viable. And so that's where that came from. So, no, I don't believe that my perceptions are skewed by my personal situation. But I can tell you as a person who believes strongly in protecting the unborn that it was something that was important to me generally.
And if young women make the decision to cross the border into Mexico and avail themselves of services that are diminishing in Texas and perhaps increasing and more available on the other side of the border under circumstances that there's no sort of regulatory environment for, you're comfortable with that?
Well, I'm not comfortable with that. And I don't like that argument. I've heard that before. One of the first articles that came out was saying that, you know, this is going to result in abortion mills popping up all along the south of the border. I don't subscribe to that belief. I mean, one, I don't think these surgical centers are going to close. So I think they're going to remain available. Even if they don't, these people who are going to want this procedure are able to drive a short distance, it could be 100 miles, it could be 200 miles, in order to get this procedure that they need. So to suggest that, you know, there's going to be a significant number of people that go into Mexico to receive the abortion pill overnight, I don't buy that argument. I think that's one that's a scare tactic that's used by the other side. I don't sense that that's happening. I don't think there are any real statistics that show that that's occurring or will occur. And I just don't believe it's an accurate assessment of what will happen.
Before we go, you referred a number of times to the other side, and I understand what you're talking about there. Is there an other side within the Latino community? And in that community, what's the argument like when you deal with constituents who maybe don't feel the way that you feel about this?
As far as the Latino community is concerned, it's curious to me that these arguments are deriving from the Latino community. If you go into the Latino community in any real capacity, you'll find quite quickly that this is a community that believes strongly in the culture of life. They're disproportionately Catholic, and they're pro-life. And so if you look and ask Hispanics how they feel about these issues, they're overwhelmingly pro-life. And so I don't sense that there's a great outcry from the Latino community against what has occurred. I think we have heard from voices within the Latino community, and of course we're going to have a different perspectives from different constituencies. But I think generally the Hispanic community is probably more pro-life than the Anglo community.
So, at the risk of being an insensitive journalist who's only concerned about political numbers, et cetera, I am talking to a politician, however, a principled one. What do you say to the notion that, unlike issues like, say, immigration, which appear to be pushing Latinos away from the GOP, do you believe abortion will pull Latinos into the GOP in the state of Texas between now and 2016?
Surely people don't believe that Republicans are proposing this kind of legislation purely to gain political favor. There are other ways that the party could do that that wouldn't be so divisive, because we recognize this is a divisive a topic, and we know that some people feel very strongly about this who don't agree with us. And so, you know, I'm concerned about that. Now, as immigration is concerned from the Latino community's perspective, you know, that's one where I believe our party has to do a better job of reaching out to Latinos in a real and meaningful way and, you know, talk about and articulate why it is that Republicans and Republican values better align with the philosophies and principles of the Hispanic community than our friends in the Democratic Party. And I don't think we've done a good job at that. And I think some of the rhetoric from our side has been a little white hot and has been pejorative and pushed away some of my brothers and sisters in the Latino communities. But I think we're on the right side of their beliefs and principles on the life issue, and I'll continue to fight for that because I think it's important.
All right. Texas State Representative Jason Villalba, Republican from Dallas, thanks so much.
John, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having this conversation. I'm glad that you'd give me the opportunity to describe a little bit about our perspective on this issue.
There's a very different debate going on among you folks out there, the neat desk people and the messy desk people. You know who you are.
I try to always keep my desk neat because I feel like it lets people think that I'm in control of the situation.
My workspace is always cluttered. I think that says that I'm able to work through any situation and in any condition.
Your story, please, at 877-8-MY-TAKE. So the big baseball hero takes the field.
The third baseman, number 13, Alex Rodriguez.
Superstar Alex Rodriguez batting cleanup for the Yankees and finally coming back to play. The only bit of drama last night in the 8-1 bludgeoning of the Yankees by the White Sox. But the A-Rod story is much bigger than the game. In fact, bigger than all the Major League games last night. After months of rumors and dithering and lawyering, Major League Baseball announced suspensions and performance drug violations for 13 players. All but one accepted the penalties and will miss 50 games. But Lucky 13 A-Rod is appealing. He also got a much bigger suspension, 211 games, the rest of this season and next season. But because he is appealing, he is permitted to play until a decision sometime later this year.
I'm sure there's been mistakes made along the way. We're here now. I'm a human being. I've had two hip surgeries. I've had two knee surgeries. I'm fighting for my life. I have to defend myself. If I don't defend myself, no one else will.
Can he defend himself, though? Joining us now, Jay Goldberg spent 15 years as a sports agent. He owns Bergino Baseball Clubhouse, which is a baseball-related shop and gallery right here in New York City. Jay, welcome.
Thanks. A pleasure.
So what do you make of the Rodriguez brand at this point? The tabloid headlines calling him a bum, et cetera, aren't exactly complimentary.
No, they're not, although that brand has been around for a long time already with A-Rod. I don't think that part has changed. None of this is a surprise.
Why do the majority of the suspensions result in acceptances and these players sort of deciding to lose their 50 games and go on? And why does A-Rod decide to appeal and suffer this 211-game suspension?
That is the great question, and that's what we're going to find out. Assuming A-Rod does go through with this appeal, there's still a chance, a slim chance, but I think there is a chance there could be a settlement in the next day or two. It's possible. Not likely, but possible. But assuming this does go through, why did certain guys get 50 games? Why did everyone get 50 games other than Ryan Braun, who got 65, and A-Rod got 211? That's really the crux of this.
What is it about this biogenesis scandal that is different from previous performance-enhancing drug scandals that sets this apart, that appears to give Major League Baseball so much more leverage? And again, we don't hold many of the cards right now.
Yeah, we don't know most of the evidence. If assuming A-Rod goes through with the appeal, we're going to find everything out, both what A-Rod did and what Major League Baseball did with Biogenesis and Anthony Bosch, the owner, the owner of Biogenesis, which may not look too good for Major League Baseball, potentially, if all that comes out.
And it's Bosch's word, apparently, versus these players. And it's my understanding that none of these players has actually failed a drug test. Certainly A-Rod has not failed a drug test.
Right. None of these players of this group have failed a drug test. And that's another very interesting part of this whole situation.
It doesn't feel like a smoking gun, and yet these 12 players basically said, we're not going to fight this.
Yeah, the question is, I think in some way that answers the question of is 50 games a deterrent? If every player took the settlement, I think it answers the question that 50 games is not a deterrent. So I think that's something that'll have to be discussed as well.
So thinking about branding here, what happens to all the A-Rod memorabilia in your shop? Does that go to the front right by the window, or does that go in the back in the closet?
Well, for better or worse, we have no A-Rod memorabilia in our shop. We have no current player, actually, in our shop. It's all a love letter to baseball, to the past. So we haven't been impacted as far as the steroid situation goes.
And in terms of A-Rod's future, this pretty much disqualifies him for the Hall of Fame, disqualifies him for even the record book, unless he comes back and has an unbelievable season in 2015.
It does not necessarily disqualify him for the Hall of Fame. Will Barry Bonds one day get in? It's possible. There's another interesting story, though. A-Rod is actually 13 home runs away from passing or tying Willie Mays. He's 67 home runs away from Babe Ruth. What happens if he does play, and what happens if he hits those numbers at some point? That'll be another circus show.
Although Pete Rose holds all kinds of records, and he's banned for life because of his gambling problems.
Right. That's why he can't make the Hall of Fame, because he was banned for life. The other players who got in trouble, in theory, could make the Hall of Fame. Pete Rose cannot.
So in your view, and the people that you talk to in your shop and your pals, and what do the agents think for that matter? Is A-Rod a victim here, or has he really just blown it? I mean, he does feel like a three-time loser here.
Yeah, it's hard to view him as a victim. He's not a likable person. I don't mean personally. I've never met him. Most people have never met him, obviously. Which is partly why they decided...
We could ask Madonna, I suppose, right?
Yeah, that'll probably be a book unto itself.
Exactly.
But he's not likable, he's the easy target.
Do you think 211 games is too big of a sentence here? Does it invite the appeal, invite a challenge?
I think it did invite the challenge. I think if the commissioner did not get swept up in greed and some other reasons why he did this and just would have offered A-Rod... Here's 50 games like every other guy. My sense is A-Rod would have accepted it.
So Selig had a chance to put this to rest in your view, and he may have overreached here, and that's going to keep this issue going.
Absolutely. He definitely overreached.
All right. Jay Goldberg spent 15 years as a sports agent. Would you say, as putting your agent mind on here, that is A-Rod still valuable as a baseball star at this point, or is he more of a liability?
He's most likely a liability. Just given his age, it doesn't look like he's going to be the player that he was, obviously.
Today, Jay Goldberg is the owner of the Bergino Baseball Clubhouse, a baseball-related shop and gallery right here in New York City. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We're hearing from you about whether those suspensions are the right move. Our number is 877-8-MY-TAKE. On Facebook, Chris told us, sad for A-Rod. He has no one to blame for himself, But it's the culture, too. Not too sure if all of us wouldn't do the same for millions of dollars. Take this drug and you'll heal faster. Get back in the game. No one will take your spot. Kevin says, if an organization isn't going to tolerate performance-enhancing drugs, then this sends a clear message that they don't tolerate performance-enhancing drugs. Plain and simple, the days of whack-a-mole in dealing with doping may be ending. You can add to this conversation on Facebook at facebook.com/thetakeaway. And you can always call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway, all one word, at The Takeaway. Now let's try and settle this question of messy desks and disorderly conduct.
Despite my best intentions, it's usually a bit messy. I think my desk pretty well projects the image of me, a worker and a dreamer.
Workers, dreamers. Well, when I checked in and saw all of you responding to our question of this messy desk thing, it was like a homecoming or some 12-step program group hug. You see, me and desks go back a very long way. There was the big old wooden presidential-looking desk that I can still remember hiding under as a toddler. The smell of that desk I can still remember, and how the large side drawers contained ancient stuff that just sat there forever, while the top drawer had all kinds of things we used every day, pencils, little knives, magnifying glasses. I actually used to work in a factory that made desks for the big office furniture company Steelcase one summer before college. Miserable job. But my real desk anxiety came in third grade. My teacher, Mrs. Bolton, who hated messy desks, would during recess dump my messy desk on the floor and have me go through its geological contents, wrinkled up old homework fused with moldy half sandwiches, in front of the whole giggling class. It was utterly humiliating. Mrs. Bolton was fond of saying, "A messy desk means a messy mind." And you can go to thetakeaway.org and see my desk today and decide about the Bolton rule in my case. 40 years later, though, can we resolve this? Is a messy desk an indication of function or dysfunction? Researchers at the University of Minnesota designed an experiment. They randomly assigned students to disorderly rooms and orderly rooms, and guess which group exhibited more creativity? Ryan Rahanel is one of the authors of the study. Welcome to the program, Ryan.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
So I've got to know, the fact that I have a messy desk means that I'm a really interesting, creative, flexible, artist kind of person, right?
That's certainly what our studies would suggest, actually.
Oh, good. That's excellent. So the fact that my third grade teacher said that a messy desk means a messy mind, that's not scientific at all. And in fact, it might be a form of abuse.
Well, I'm not so sure if we call it abuse, but, you know, we are finding that there are different implications of having a messy environment than what we've previously known.
What do you think about the sort of food chain idea that the people who are, you know, at the top of the food chain in the management hierarchy typically have the desk with nothing on it except maybe a pen or, you know, a gold-plated something. And it's the people who do the real work that actually have cluttered desks.
There are a lot of reasons why that might happen other than wanting to be creative or wanting to stay within the traditional guidelines. However, our studies would suggest that, you know, if there is someone with a clean desk, they might just want to stay within tradition, want to stay within the typical conventions of behavior. And if you have a messy desk, you know, maybe that's a signal that that person's trying to be creative. They're trying to think outside the box. And we're really suggesting that there might be ways in which you might want to structure your environment if you're a manager for your employees, depending on what their job type might be. And, you know, we thought, well, you know, if messiness or disorganization is so prominent in society, in nature, why is that? Why is it, if it's so bad, why is it still so prominent? And so we thought, you know, it might actually suit different behaviors. And so things like creativity, which are typically seen as, you know, very desirable behaviors, we were really surprised, I guess, is one word to describe how we felt that, you know, messiness or disorganization really encouraged that. And it's really hard to change creativity in the moment. I think a lot of people think of creativity as, something that someone either has or doesn't have. And to change that in the moment with a single person, just by changing their environment, I think that's something that's really striking with our findings.
It is amazing, that's for sure. I'm going to definitely go into my office and mess it up a little bit more so this will be a better show. I think that's the lesson there. Ryan, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me, John.
Good luck with that PhD.
Thanks.
Ryan Rahanel is a PhD candidate at the Carlson School of Management at the University of Minnesota and co-author of that recent study on messy desks and creative behavior. Shockwaves in the nation's capital now. The Washington Post, one of the country's oldest newspapers, family-owned for more than 80 years, is being sold to Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, a man who became a billionaire in Washington State, now pockets the signature Washington, D.C. paper for a cool $250 million. Reporting on this shocker, Cheryl Gay Stolberg, political features writer for our partner, The New York Times. Her profile of Catherine Weymouth, one of the Graham family who owns the Post, was published only days before the sale was announced. Cheryl, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
This is the end, I suppose, or the next chapter of a very, very long narrative in American journalistic history and in the history of a Washington family. Remind us of just how far back this goes.
You know, the Grahams really have been Washington royalty ever since Eugene Meyer, Catherine Graham's father, bought the Washington Post at a bankruptcy sale in 1933. He had been a Federal Reserve chairman, and ever since that purchase, Washingtonians have observed the Grahams and scrutinized and mythologized them the way the British scrutinized their royalty, especially Catherine Graham, who oversaw the Post during its heyday of Watergate.
Describe the generation that is supervising this sale and how it either stands in contrast to the legacy of Catherine Graham and Donald Graham, who succeeded her, and going back to Eugene Meyer.
Well, the current publisher of the Post is Catherine Weymouth, who is Catherine Graham's granddaughter and Donald Graham's niece. Donald Graham is Catherine Graham's son. And, you know, we've seen through successive generations the family really trying to hold on to its crown jewel, the newspaper, in a time of great changes in our industry. Journalism is not what it was. Newspapers are not what they were. When Kay Graham ruled Washington, she ruled social Washington. She was a doyenne. She had dinners. She danced with Ronald Reagan on her 70th birthday. Don Graham, her son, took over and really demonstrated himself to be committed to the business of journalism and to the city of Washington. You know, he was a Washington policeman before ever joining the Washington Post. He worked as a reporter. He worked his way up through the newsroom. He's very much beloved and viewed as a defender of the family legacy, which is why this sale is so poignant. And it seems to me that, unlike other newspaper families who've maybe sold to cash out, the Grahams sold the Post to save the Post. And to me, that's what makes it all the more poignant.
I'm wondering if the difference between Lally Weymouth, who's the mom of the current publisher, who was very, very passionate about issues and was very, very involved in politics and sort of opinion making in Washington, is different from her daughter in the sense that they're more about the business.
You know, back when Kay Graham ran the newspaper, and even during Lally's heyday as a reporter, newspapers were flush with advertising. Newspapers didn't have to worry about the internet. People were still getting newspapers delivered to their doorstep. Now, if you look at the economics of the newspaper industry and the Post in particular, circulation is declining. Ad revenue is declining. The Post has to deal with competition from outlets like Politico, co-founded by two longtime Post reporters. So It's a very different climate, and I think that I truly don't think they're any less committed or more about the business. I think that they are struggling in a time that is very, very tough for publishers everywhere. You know, a longtime Post reporter told me that yesterday inside the newsroom that Don Graham said he really had a lot of faith in Jeff Bezos, and that people at the Post saw Don Graham looking so sad about having to sell the paper, but they kind of felt like, you know what, if Don says it's going to be a good thing for the Post, then we believe him. Maybe it is going to be a good thing for the Post. So I think everybody inside the Post, starting with the Grahams, is clinging to that hope that Jeff Bezos has found the magic bullet, that saving a family newspaper meant relinquishing family control to somebody who maybe has smarter ideas or more savvy in the digital world.
Great emotional moment there you convey. Cheryl Gay Stolberg, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Cheryl Gay Stolberg is Washington-based political features writer for our partner, The New York Times. So last week, it was the private Bradley Manning verdict before a military court that made military history. This week, another trial with a very different set of issues and possible legal precedents. 4 years ago this November, Major Nidal Malik Hassan opened fire on soldiers at the Fort Hood Army Base in Killeen, Texas, killing 13 people, injuring many more. Today, Major Hassan's trial begins. He faces 13 counts of premeditated murder and 32 counts of attempted premeditated murder. Joining us now, Jeffrey Korn is a former Army prosecutor and defense lawyer, currently a professor at the South Texas College of Law. Jeffrey Korn, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
What are the unique issues here in this case of Major Hassan, who I understand is defending himself?
Well, I think the fact that he's defending himself is certainly one thing that's unusual in a military court. We don't see that very often, although military defendants have the same constitutional right as any other American to represent themselves. What I think is particularly significant about this case is the gravity of the carnage that he inflicted. And I've seen some of the evidence. I've been to the pretrial hearing. And I think when the public starts to see the media and press reports on what happened in that building that day, it really is going to be heart-moving and tragic, because it was absolute mayhem.
In a sense, not unlike the Bradley Manning case, there's not so much a question of guilt here. The facts speak for themselves, but there is a question about why Major Hassan was in the position he was in the military, and why the apparent warning signs that either he delivered or others delivered about his state of mind weren't followed within the normal chain of command. Will that come up in this trial at all?
You know, I think if he hadn't fired his lawyers, it would have been a significant feature of the sentencing phase of the case, because it's very common in military trials during sentencing of a defendant that's been convicted for the defense to point out failures of leadership. Obviously, in front of a military jury, if the chain of command has failed in their responsibility, that might influence the jury to be a little bit more lenient on the defendant. And I think if his defense lawyers really had planned to make that a feature of their effort to save him from capital punishment, but he can't do that himself. He can't make that argument himself in sentencing. He can't really get up and say, you know, I was unfit for military service way back when, and nobody noticed it, and that's why I was able to get away with this. So I actually think, because he's chosen to defend himself, that will not be a significant feature of this court-martial.
Does that deny the public a discussion in open court of an issue that is important to the military and that Americans need to understand? And what's the danger that this will just become a kind of circus trial like we saw after 9/11, when defendants attempted to defend themselves and it became a very emotional but utterly superficial kind of ideological discussion in court?
Well, I don't think he's going to be disruptive. I know there have been some experts who said that he's going to use this as a platform to try and disrupt the process. That's not my perception of him from what I've seen and from what I know. I actually think he's going to be relatively passive, and he's particularly on the issue of guilt or innocence. He's basically admitted guilt in these statements he's made recently to Fox News. I do think during the sentencing phase, he's going to use it as an opportunity to articulate his, what I believe is, warped belief that what he was doing was religiously and morally justified. Now, on the issue of depriving the public of, you know, a full airing of how he got to this point, there already have been, and there will be very significant inquiries into this process. Congress has done some reports. So that's already out there. And candidly, I don't think anybody in the chain of command could have predicted that even with the signals he was sending, that this was an individual that would resort to this type of carnage to fulfill his distorted view of what's right and wrong.
What has he been forbidden to say about his views of Islam, and what has the prosecution been forbidden to introduce in evidence as an indication that he was actively seeking help from wanted militants and Islamists around the world, including Anwar al-Awlaki?
Right. The apparent emails between him and al-Awlaki have garnered a lot of attention. I haven't seen them. I don't know if many people have actually seen the content of the emails. And I'm not so sure they're as compelling as people assume they are. I suspect that he was trying to make contact with al-Awlaki. And I actually think al-Awlaki would have had to have been a fool to be actively responding to him, because he's a major in the United States Army. I mean, al-Awlaki was probably laughing when he was receiving these emails, like, you really think I'm going to engage in a discussion with you? Nonetheless, he saw al-Awlaki as his mentor, and the prosecution is permitted to offer that evidence because it's relevant on the issue of motive. And motive is an important method of proving intent and premeditation, which are the legal elements they must prove to convict him of premeditated murder. But candidly, I don't think it's going to be all that compelling. The really compelling evidence is all the evidence of the planning that is unrelated to those emails, like reconnoitering the crime scene, the choreography of the attack, the volume of ammunition, the two laser sights, one green and one red, which facilitate shooting indoors and outdoors, and other evidence that clearly indicates he had been planning this for some time.
You think he's headed for execution here?
I think he is headed for a sentence of death. Irrespective of what you believe about the death penalty, if the death penalty is authorized by law, which it is in the military, then I can't imagine how it couldn't be appropriate in a case like this. In other words, if you're going to have the death penalty, this is the case for it. Whether he will ever be executed is another issue. We haven't executed a military defendant since President Johnson was in office, and there are some experts who say this has been an enormous waste of time and money because he will never be executed.
Well, a lot of precedent there, that's for sure. Jeffrey Korn is a former Army prosecutor and defense lawyer. He's currently a professor at the South Texas College of Law. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, continuing our discussion on PTSD.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention. Dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
And now a flashback and a flash forward. This week we're exploring the individual and collective experience of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, in America as we enter the long aftermath of two wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. More than one in five of the more than 2 million combat veterans from those wars has some symptoms of PTSD. It's a complicated and mysterious phenomenon and tantalizing. The Jason Bourne movies were all about a soldier who is deliberately given symptoms of PTSD to make him an effective killing machine, but he can't fight the flashbacks of who he really is.
I just can't stay with it.
But you're sure it's not just
a
bad dream?
It was a mission. And I was there.
You should write it down.
Now, 2 years, we're scribbling in that notebook.
It hasn't
been 2 years. It's always
bad,
and now it's just the same thing over and over again.
But that's why we write it down. Because sooner or later, you remember something good.
I do remember something good. All the time.
PTSD, of course, is not about movie plots and mind control. It is about identity, though. For screenwriter Matt Cook, his identity changed after the 9/11 attacks, after serving in the war in Iraq as a soldier, and then going back to the battlefield as a civilian. He recently wrote about his experiences in Afghanistan for Texas Monthly magazine. It was a journey from movie mythology to his own grim reality.
You know, before I even joined the military, I sort of romanticized that pain that these guys had felt, and I kind of wanted those to share those experiences. Oddly enough, I felt like I needed to connect myself to something like that in a major way to kind of fulfill, you know, the sort of rite of passage that I wanted, you know, to become a man. And I guess when, you know, you watch those movies and you see what these guys went through when they came home from war, I wanted to know their experiences, and I wanted to kind of taste their pain in a way. I mean, my first day of basic training was September 11th, so I certainly didn't enlist thinking I would see or taste any of it.
When you say you got more than a taste, though, is there a particular set of experiences that you associate with PTSD itself, that there's a particular experience that comes back again and again?
I would say that there are some more so than others. My first firefight was an ambush, and there were six of us, and two friends of mine were killed, another was wounded, and, you know, three of us kind of walked away without a scratch. So that one haunts me quite a bit. But, you know, in two tours of war in Iraq, you know, you lose friends and you lose your own soldiers along the way. And so, you know, there's some that I think about more than others. But overall, it's just, it was a pretty maddening experience.
Is it the gore and the sort of brutality, or is it the sense of why did you survive and my buddy didn't, that is the thing that stays with you and generates the stress?
It's definitely the survivor's guilt. I don't think I've ever really struggled so much with the blood and the gore. It's definitely sort of this idea that the war arbitrarily took friends, took people you knew, and, you know, you survived these IEDs and sniper attacks, and you, you know, it's kind of trying to comprehend why you survived when these other people didn't.
Do you have a insight into what death is like because of those experiences, or is it even more of a mystery?
I think it's the opposite. I don't think I have an insight to what death is like. I think I have more of an insight into what life is like. You know, you experience the highest of the highs and the lowest of the lows when you go through those sort of things. And I think when you come back, you know, these experiences really open a void in your life. And so I think they carry over into everyday experiences. And I think that's why when these guys come home and when we came home, you're looking for something to kind of fill that void. And there's nothing in normal civilian life that sort of, you know, you find that satisfaction. And so I don't think it's about an understanding of death as it is as much as like a search for something to keep living for.
You also found healing by going back into the war zone, even when you understood some of these void issues, question of what you needed to live for. Did you go back because you felt like you were just a misfit in civilian life, or did you go back searching for some kind of closure?
It definitely wasn't because I feel like a misfit. I think, if anything, I felt like I was too comfortable in life. And I think one of the biggest issues with guys coming home having these experiences is the indifference that our country sort of has to our wars and to our veterans. And I felt myself becoming them. I just couldn't stand myself sometimes. I look in the mirror and I'd be like, man, I've really adjusted and I'm not even thinking about the war anymore. And that's not... it's not the person I kind of wanted to be. So for me, it was reconnecting to something that had really changed and affected me and turned me into the man I was. I just felt like I needed to go and reconnect. But it's a hard pill to swallow when you come home and everything you've fought for and sacrificed for is just kind of, you know, it's blasé. And it's hard. You have to turn into yourself to deal with things.
You know, here's a hard question. I mean, Americans' lives have not really been changed very much by the experience of both of these wars. In certain aspects, yes, but in sort of day-to-day aspects, no. Isn't that the nature of these wars conducted so far away on rationales that are abstract? They're not tangible. They're not like what happened in World War II. It's the nature of these two crazy wars.
Well, I think a lot of that is because there's never been, or at least for me, a clear sense of what we're doing. And and why we fought the wars to begin with. I'll never understand why we went to Iraq. And you know, I've tried, and I think no number of excuses will kind of help me rationalize why we were there. But I'm extremely proud that I took part of it, and that I knew the men and women that I served with. And as much as I hated the war, I'm very, very proud that I was a part of it.
Do you have kids?
I don't.
But one of these days, your child, should that come about, will say, "What did you do in the war, Daddy?" Will you be the PTSD dad who suppresses the experience and doesn't really talk about it, or will you have something to say?
I don't know. I think if I feel like I have something to say, I'll say it. I don't think I've ever been one to repress. I think some guys genuinely do repress their experiences and don't want to talk about it. I feel like some guys feel like they're supposed to repress it because that's the stereotype. But I will say that one day, if I do have children and they want to serve in the military, I think that I would encourage them to do so.
Even given what you've been through?
Especially given what I've been through. I've learned more about people. I've learned more about life than I would have ever had I not enlisted in the military.
Matt Cook, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Matt Cook is a former service member in the Iraq War. He wrote about his experience returning from war and then traveling to Afghanistan as a civilian for Texas Monthly Magazine. It's a real question for all of us. Do you feel connected to this experience of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, this collective experience of PTSD, or are you remote from it, as Matt was talking about? We're going to be hearing stories of post-traumatic stress syndrome on our men and women in uniform returning home from the wars. We want to hear stories from you and your family. Do you have loved ones suffering from PTSD? How are they coping? How can we, all of us civilians in America, help? How are we involved in this experience? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE to share your story. We want you to get an early jump on all of our conversations. Let me remind you to be a part of our listener response network. You can sign up for our texts, one text a day. We ask you a question featured on the next day's program, so your voice becomes part of the on-air conversation. All you have to do is text the word START to 69866. That's START to 69866 and join the conversation. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.